Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, July 3rd, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you, Nima. Thanks for the invite, and all the best to you and your viewers.
Let's get started, Alex, with the NATO summit and the outcome of that and the way that the United States is somehow... The United States has decided not to send more aids to Ukraine in terms of weapons. And here is what the U.S. ambassador to NATO said on Fox News.
You just a week after your time with President Trump at the NATO meeting. But first, give us your reaction to the U.S. holding back now on these weapons to Ukraine.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Maria. I think the most important thing to know is that this is what America First looks like. We first have to take care of the United States' needs. And this is something the Pentagon does all the time, make sure that the United States has the strategic defense capabilities necessary to project power. And so we have to make sure that we have enough Patriot missiles and we have enough air defense and all the things that we need to ensure our own success on the battlefield, wherever that battlefield might be. You saw our great capabilities on the B-2 bombers when they dropped the precision-guided bunker busters on Iran. And so, you know, the world wants that. We saw that with our NATO allies last week. They want to be allied with us so that we can bring those capabilities. And, you know, we just need to make sure that we have what we need at any time to deter and defend ourselves on a credible basis.
How do you see your take on what's going on with Trump? And is that going to be consistent? Are they going to really stop sending weapons to Ukraine?
I do think so, Nima. I mean, you know, I'm sure that there are channels of contacts there and networks of mutual support that are still alive, but I think they're getting gradually and progressively shut down. Because it doesn't make sense for the United States to continue pouring its assets into a project that's already failed. And right now, the United States is being asked to provide security guarantees to Ukraine, military support, financial support. It's all costs with next to no upside for the US. So what's the point? I think that Trump and his administration were sincere when they said that they wish to move away from the post-World War II global order, you know, the rules-based global order, and to embrace multipolar integrations. And, you know, both the wars in the war on Iran in the Middle East and the war on Russia through Ukraine are ultimately imperial wars. They are the wars of the rules-based global order, which wishes to impose their hegemony over the whole Eurasian landmass. They want to destroy regime change and partition Russia. They want to regime change Iran. This is the kind of thing that either you're with them or you're not with them. You know, you can't. It doesn't make sense to be with them a little bit, to continue to support Ukraine a little bit, to be hostile with Iran a little bit. You're either on one side of the divide or on the other side. And if I set aside the rhetoric, because the rhetoric is very confusing, you know, one day they say this, the next day they say that. But when I look at the outcome of what is going on, of the events and their results, it seems to me that the Trump team is consistent, and it's clear that they wish to extricate the United States from these globalist misadventures and to really embrace the multipolar integrations. So, you know, they want to negotiate with Iran, not even about the nuclear program. They don't want a regime change. They want to negotiate bigger things, you know. Iran has a lot of oil, as Trump said. So they probably wish to develop that potential. And, you know, they what happened when I think it was Hegseth that gave an interview about a week ago, and he was asked if no, it was Witkoff. Sorry, Witkoff gave an interview, and they asked him about whether the United States is going to seek further sanctions on Iran or if there's going to be a lifting of sanctions. And he generally expressed himself in favor of lifting the sanctions and easing them. And when among other things, he said, this is a message to China. And the signal was, we are ready to make deals. We're ready to go beyond this role of policing everybody, imposing sanctions, punishing countries, forcing everybody to toe our line. And I think that this is what they're doing. That's, you know, when I set the rhetoric aside and I look at what they are doing, this is consistently the signal. Also, last week we had a piece of news which maybe went largely below the radar, but there was a unit set up under, I think, NSA, National Security Agency, that was tasked with kind of antagonizing Russia and increasing pressure on Russia in order to force them into negotiations, exploring strategies for that, including false flag attacks and all this. Well, Trump just dissolved this body. They sacked all the people that were in this committee, and they discontinued it. So, you know, that's another signal saying that we're done with Project Ukraine. You know, it's a lost cause. So we move on.
Since you've mentioned, I wanted to focus on Ukraine, but since you've mentioned the case of Iran, Alex, when Donald Trump he has decided to share Jeffrey Sachs' video and about Netanyahu, attacking Netanyahu, by the way, putting blame on Netanyahu about all these wars in the Middle East, endless wars of the United States. And he went to the Middle East. He didn't go to Israel. Somehow strange, it didn't happen in his first term. And with the case of, and we know what has happened during 12 days of war between Iran and Israel. We have, you look at the pictures, they don't let to any sort of information, that much of information coming out from Israel, coming out to the media. But from what we've learned from the pictures, from the videos that we've seen, you see the scenes look like Gaza. You know, Netanyahu coming from a position that they were going to destroy Iran, do regime change Iran, and right now in a position that he's not feeling good in Israel in terms of what's going against him. And Donald Trump comes out. For us, that I saw that Netanyahu, this sort of weakening of Netanyahu is somehow beneficial for Donald Trump. He can go and find and beat Netanyahu in that term. But it didn't happen on the scene. On the scene, you don't see that happen. He goes and support Netanyahu in Israel. It seems that somehow he feels a weakened Netanyahu, a defeated one, is better than any other option for him for the time being. What's your take on that, the way that he supported, he tried to force the judicial system of Israel in order to help Netanyahu?
So that's, I agree with you that that's difficult to explain. And so, you know, obviously we're going to have to speculate a little bit, but it seems to me that Donald Trump, I think that he kind of maneuvered Netanyahu where he wanted him, and that Netanyahu has maybe, you know, come around to at least overtly support Donald Trump. You know, they went with a big thank you to Donald Trump and all this. And so now if he's overthrown, if he gets impeached, then who knows what happens from there? You see, one interesting thing that happened during this 12-day war is that the Americans came, well, Trump came out and he said, we obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. We completely obliterated it. It is vaporized. It doesn't exist anymore. What has he done with this? He has removed the West's justification for war on Iran. Because, you know, they didn't really tell us that they want a regime change. They said, oh, we must remove the nuclear program because that's too dangerous and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, the public in the West thinks like, well, you know, the Iranian regime is so, so dangerous. They invade somebody every 300 years or so, right? So they cannot have nuclear weapons. So you have a pretext to act, you know. So if you bomb them, then people say like, okay, well, you know, it's for a good reason, I guess. It's illegal, it's immoral, it's wrong, but, you know, it's for the greater good so that the Iranians don't get a nuclear bomb, because then they're just going to bomb us all because they're so horrible and hateful and medieval and irrational. So now you say, okay, the nuclear program is gone, it's gone, it's like vaporized. So now there's no more pretext for war. And Netanyahu immediately jumped on this because he needed the political boost. You know, he needed to show a victory, a major strategic victory over the big enemy, Iran. So he immediately bought into this whole Trump project of destroying Iran's nuclear program. And now if he stays there in power, then I think that Trump kind of maneuvered him into accepting peace, into standing down, calling off further attacks on Iran, and now having to negotiate peace with Hamas. If they remove Netanyahu, then we're back to square one, because whoever takes over next might say, no, the nuclear program was not destroyed. We have to go back to attacking Iran. And no peace in Gaza. We carry on bombing them and we carry on waging war till the end. So maybe in order to try to pursue peace, he prefers to be dealing with Netanyahu than to be dealing with the next unknown, whoever that might be. But I suspect that it's going to be somebody even more to the loony fringe than Netanyahu already is. You know, the messianic fanatics who don't even have a rational thought about the whole situation. They're just going to go all the way to Armageddon without stopping.
Alex, what we've learned during the war and in the aftermath of the war and IAEA, with the situation with IAEA, Iran has decided to cut all these talks, communications between Iran and IAEA, and we know that Palantir was part of this AI system within IAEA to help Israelis, intelligence and organizations, all of this. It's not just about Iran. It's about Russia, Iran, China, those countries that have nuclear program. It was a sign for all these countries that are somehow communicating in IAEA. How is that going to influence? Because it's not just about these people, it's about what's behind the scene, what's going on, what do they want from the nuclear programs in those countries? And that could put these countries in somehow in a vulnerable position. You remember the attack on nuclear bombers of Russia. These are not something, these are huge things. These countries are behaving rationally, logically. They're not reacting that much to understand. But if it was on the United States or any other, I don't know, Germany or other countries, they're going to react. But Russia was behaving rationally. Iran tried to calm down. How do you see IAEA and these organizations and the way the future of the communication between Russia, China, Iran, and all those countries that don't, that the West doesn't see them as friendly, as someone to work with, to collaborate with?
Well, I think that it's quite obvious that IAEA has been compromised and they have effectively taken advantage of Iran's compliance to help Iran's enemies undermine Iran, to target their program, to target their scientists, and to pass the necessary information to the Israelis, to Western intelligence services, in order to be able to target the vulnerable spots in Iran. So I think that the Iranians are fully in their right to throw IAEA out. And I think that, you know, this will force this will force an overhaul, because this, you know, using IAEA in this way is also an attack not just on Iran, but it's an attack on the rule of international law. These agencies, in fact, serve as a, you know, they serve a policing function. So they say, okay, you have to abide by these rules, so we're going to observe your compliance. Well, if the observation and policing becomes weaponized against you, then obviously you can't continue to comply, because it's directly to your detriment and to the benefit of your enemies. So I think that, you know, while I think that the Russians and the Chinese perfectly understand this, and I think that neither them nor the Iranians intend to undermine the rule of international law, because, you know, like, without international law, we have chaos. We have potentially war of everybody on against everybody with no, you know, with no holds barred. You know, it would be chaos. But I think that Iran will demand major concessions in order to come back into those types of arrangements. And the concessions will be, well, okay, Israel's going to have to sign a non-proliferation treaty. IAEA inspectors are going to have to go there and see what's there, you know, what's how many warheads they have, what's at the Dimona, what's so if we subject ourselves to an inspection regime, then Israel has to subject themselves to the same exact inspection regime as well. And then, you know, I think by now everybody understands that this whole mess with the Iran nuclear program is almost contrived. It's not real. They are pushing this line because they want to the regime change. But, you know, since we in the West support the rule of law and democracy and freedom and human rights, then we can't overtly say, well, yeah, we want to install the Shah in Tehran and we want to overthrow the current government of Iran, which is, you know, democratically elected. You like it or not, but that's a fact. So they have to harp on this nuclear program. But, you know, the whole world by now sees, okay, here's Libya, who gave up their nuclear program, and it got attacked. Muammar Gaddafi got overthrown, he got killed, and the country got completely destroyed. It went from being the most advanced country in Africa to being a failed state in just a few years. And then the contrast is North Korea, which didn't give up their nuclear program and which does have nuclear weapons. Well, nobody's daring to touch North Korea, right? And so I think it's you know, you have to take that into account. For Iran, they don't have a nuclear weapon. They have a fatwa against having a nuclear weapon, but they have made themselves a nuclear threshold state in order to be able to build a nuclear weapon in a short time, not because they're going to bomb anybody, because they can't, but to have a deterrent so that if their enemy decides to nuke them, they can nuke them back, so that their enemy says, like, okay, that option's off the table. We can't do that. It's a deterrent. That's the sole purpose that it serves is as a deterrent. And so I think that Iran, particularly in view of the precedents of Libya and North Korea, Iran is fully entitled to have that deterrent. And I think it's not right to demand them to give it up while demanding nothing of their enemy, you know? Curious. So like you have two adversaries and you're putting all the pressure on one side to disarm, to give up their nuclear program, to give up their missile program. And at the same time, you're asking absolutely nothing of the other side. Well, you know, that doesn't work. That's not law. This is partisanship. This is taking sides. And again, you know, as always, the fault lines is the empire versus the rest of the world. So in effect, you're taking the side of the empire and the, you know, or i.e. the global, the rules-based global order. And so I think that Iranians are fully in their right to say, no, we will no longer comply with this as is today. And I think that the Russians and the Chinese perfectly understand the situation. So, you know, they're going to be generally supportive of Iran. And then they're going to apply pressure. Okay, so if you want Iran to comply with IAEA inspections, well, then we have to force Israel to do the same.
Yeah. Alex, do you feel that what has happened to Iran would somehow strengthen the relationship, the security and military relationship between Iran and Russia? How is that going to work for the two countries, and which are somehow negotiating with the United States? But those people who were some advocating to a better relationship with the United States are getting weaker as time goes by in those countries.
I think it will strengthen the relationship between Iran and Russia. I think that it was clear that Iran needs Russia and Russia needs Iran, you know, and now it became even clearer, because I know that in Iran, there's a, you know, like there's a part of the political class that is still very distrustful of the Russians. And then, you know, maybe there's a little bit of that mutual feeling on the other side as well. But, you know, it's very obvious why Russia needs Iran. And now it's much more clear why Iran also needs Russia, because, you know, we're talking about a complete overhaul of the security architecture on the whole Eurasian continent. And Iran is practically the centerpiece of the security architecture of the West Asia or the Middle East. And we see how important that is now, especially that, you know, what was it in March, in less than 3 months ago, Azerbaijan got a new British military attaché, you know, who took office in under a British embassy in Baku. And then all of a sudden, hey, look, you know, you have Azerbaijan beginning to antagonize Russia, and they begin to antagonize Iran all at the same time. So you see the British geopolitics is continuing in operation. And if you don't set up and cement a new security architecture, that's only a guarantee that it's going to be war, more and more and more war. They're always going to find a pretext, you know. So, you know, you can find some reason to go and antagonize the Russians and start to destabilize, you know, derail the friendly relations between Russia and the Azerbaijan, which they tried to cultivate in spite of all the difficulties. Well, you know, if you blow that relationship up, then immediately you're poisoning the relations between Russia and Turkey. Because, you know, Turkey and Azerbaijan have a common interest there. And ideally, they would like to connect territorial, you know, when, on that how do you call that, that land bridge between Azerbaijan and Turkey. I forget now what the name of it is. My bad. But okay, it'll come back to me. But like, Zangezur corridor. Mm. So you know that could be the territorial connection between Turkey and Azerbaijan. So that's already like a potential crisis flashpoint, and then that's going to pull Turkey in back into the globalist camp, where they already are because of Syria. You know, because the Turks are completely in bed with the British intelligence in Syria. So it's a big, complicated mess. And then obviously the globalist forces, and I don't think it's CIA as much as it is MI6 and Mossad, who are, you know, have very close cooperation with the, you know, Azerbaijanis, with their deep state. And
yeah, this is the corridor that you were talking about.
Yes. And so that's, you know, it's the Azerbaijan is already on bad terms with Armenia, and they've been in and out of wars for the last 30 years. And we still don't have now maybe we do have a solution to that conflict, because the Armenians merely yielded to Azerbaijan's territorial ambitions. But there's still this Zangezur corridor that Baku would very much like to control. And so that might come up sometimes in the near future, particularly if you have, because, okay, one of the major strategies of the MI6 to try to dominate West Asia has been working with the Turks, with the Turkish deep state, and of course with the Azerbaijanis, because they're also Turkic people, to the British geopolitics has done for the past 200 years. They always promise concessions to regional powers. So if they want Turks to help them take over Syria, they'll take them like, oh, we'll help you against the Kurds, or we'll help you establish your kind of dominant position in among the Turkic people. And there's this project of Great Turania, you know, which goes from Turkey all the way almost to China, to Xinjiang province. And it's all these Turkic people, all the stans, you know, the Turkmenistans, the Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Azerbaijan. And then, you know, but for the Zangezur corridor connection to Turkey. So this could be the whole ginormous Great Turania, which, you know, maybe people like Aliyev or Erdogan would like to have in their legacy, that they united the Turkic people in the world and created this great political, economic entity. But then that completely derails the BRICS architecture. And not to mention that northern part of Iran is southern Azerbaijan, again, populated by majority Turkic people. So you can always use separatist movements to destabilize Iran in this way. And obviously they're moving in that direction. So I think that if you're Russia and China, this is a sign that you really need to support Iran, because Iran is the antithesis of these Western schemes to destabilize the region. And, you know, I think that Russia has been largely successful in this sense, because the British... Okay, so the current head of MI6, Sir Richard Moore, used to be the British ambassador to Turkey. And so this Great Turania was his assignment. And he, you know, he has become close friends with Erdogan, right? And he's been selling Erdogan on this Greater Turania project. And Erdogan has been very receptive. And he tried to co-opt Turkey into their war on Ukraine, on Russia and Ukraine. They wanted to bring Turkey as an as a Western ally in the in the in the proxy war against Russia and Ukraine. They wanted Turkey to support the West in Ukraine. And you know, they the Turks did a little bit, but not, and that was thanks to Russian diplomacy, because the Russians made sure, even though, you know, Turkey is not really an ally of Russia, but at least they're not an enemy. So the Turk, the Russians brought Turkey out of the Western alliance, and the Turks chose not to join the alliance against Russia. So they're kind of in a limbo, half-half. But they're not, you know, the Brits are not going to stop trying. They brought Turkey into the Project Syria. So, you know, the Turks cultivated HTS together, and together with the, you know, with the Brits, they managed all these jihadi militaries and militias to overthrow Bashar al-Assad regime. And now, you know,
using pretty much Turkic people, by the way.
Sorry?
Using the Turkic people, these.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, the Russians know that this is coming from them in the future. If they let this stand, because the Russians are very vulnerable to these jihadi terrorist groups that the West cultivates in Dagestan, in Chechnya, in Kazakhstan and elsewhere. I mean, okay, Kazakhstan is not in Russia, but I mean, you know, it's all along the soft underbelly of Russia, where they are at risk of being infiltrated by these terrorist groups. So if they consolidate their power in the Middle East, in Syria, and start gaining ground, well, then, you know, they're like, as they incubated them in Idlib to attack Syria, they can now incubate them better in Syria to eventually attack Iran and to attack ultimately Russia as well. And then China as well, through Xinjiang. So I think there's no question that the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians are aware of all this, and that they need to counter it. Now, how dangerous is all this? I honestly don't know, but I feel that it has to be a bit less dangerous than Ukraine, because if it was, let's say, if that line of attack was more viable than Ukraine, then the West would have chosen that line of attack rather than Ukraine. But they didn't. They chose Ukraine. So that this means that this is their plan B or C or something else. You know, this is they're trying to stir the pot in Azerbaijan and Iran and Armenia and so forth, because they are running out of options. So this is, they're playing a weaker card, I think. But we'll find out. This new escalation of hostilities between Russia and Azerbaijan and Iran, this is relatively new. So it'll take time for us to see where it's going exactly.
I think in their mind, with the fall of Iranian government, they could have put a puppet regime in Iran, then they go to the plan B and the backup plan. That,
yeah, exactly. It didn't work out.
Yeah, exactly. Alex, you mentioned the British role and with the case of Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan, Israelis were using Azerbaijani airspace to attack Iran. And right now the new tensions, I don't know why. It's somehow ridiculous when you look at the way that they're behaving in Azerbaijan to somehow provoke Russia. And it makes sense to me the way that you mentioned this, because here is the situation in Ukraine. Donald Trump doesn't want to send more weapons to Ukraine. And you see the British are totally somehow getting more radical. Here is UK Defense Secretary talking about how they're going to support Ukraine.
And I announced that we would increase to £4 billion in this parliament the investment that we make in autonomy in drones. That's more than double that was in the budget before. It's largely capital expenditure, and we will learn the lessons from Ukraine in being able to develop not just better and produce more drones for Ukraine, which we will do this year. We will increase by at least tenfold the drones that we supply to Ukraine this year. But
you cannot deal with these people just by negotiations. You have to defeat them. You have to do something permanently, because they're going to bug you. They're going to continue attacking you. You're taking that.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that the Russians are beginning to take their gloves off, because now they have, you know, since the drone attack on their airports and their strategic nuclear bombers in Russia last month, I think, right? Sergei Lavrov and other politicians in Russia have said explicitly, you know, the Ukrainians could never have done this without the British support. And they said maybe there are still some vestiges, remnants of, you know, structures in the CIA who are also involved in this. But, you know, they no longer see the United States as an enemy. And the fact that they're explicitly saying this out loud tells you that they're done playing games. And I think that it's only a matter of time before the British are going to receive some kind of a reprisal. But you know how when a nation begins to disintegrate at home, as Britain is, then if the ruling establishment desperately needs an external enemy, they need a war, so that they can tell their people, look, everything is shit in this country, but it's not because of our government, it's because of the Russians. Look, we have to fight them, because otherwise they're going to come here and they're going to destroy our country and, you know, kill our children and rape our women and, you know, completely destroy our way of life. And so, you know, if you have the external enemy, then you can get a war going and you can completely shift people's attention from everything that's going wrong in Britain and blame everything on the Russians and say, you know, okay, so the healthcare system is falling apart. That's because, you know, we are under attack. Your pension is gone. Well, blame the Russians. There's no food in the shops. Well, you know, we have to feed the boys on the front lines, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's always the same thing, actually. Since the Roman times, whenever Rome was in trouble, they would yell barbarians at the gate. And then what they do? They send all the fighting age males to war. And they deliberately let them be decimated. Because the fighting age males are your biggest risk. That's the revolutionary force. So if they're focused on your government, that's big danger. But if you divert their attention to a foreign enemy, then you send them there, make sure that most of them get slaughtered, and then you've preserved yourself in power. So I think that this is the reason why the Russians are probably never going to attack the British, not overtly. So what I understand from, you know, sketchy sources, but, you know, I'm told that, you know, whenever the British do something to attack the Russians, to orchestrate sabotage or terrorist attacks, the Russians respond by targeting their SAS forces somewhere in the world. And they inflict a mass slaughter of them. But it all stays under the radar because, you know, very often these SAS forces are deployed secretly, illicitly. So if they get killed, the British government can't really say, oh, look, you know, our boys all got, you know, the Russians killed our boys. Because then the next question is, well, what were these boys doing in this part of the world? Why were they deployed there? So it all goes under the radar, but these mutual blows do take place. Only it doesn't rise to a media story. So then, you know, then Keir Starmer has to go out and start talking, you know, Russia is our enemy. We have to go to war against Russia. But because there's nothing forming that reality, it seems like he's unhinged. He's like talking nonsense. That's the way it appears. And I think that that's the way the Russians want to keep it for now. Because at this point, Britain doesn't need much help to disintegrate socially and politically and economically and fiscally.
Alex, what is the main objective of Emmanuel Macron that it seems that he called Putin and talked with him? And the talk between the two presidents was because Macron wanted to talk with Putin. It wasn't Putin talking with him. He wasn't in the same position for more than 3 years, 3.5 years. And he decided all of a sudden talk with Putin. What does he want? Because the United States, they're getting somehow to a point that the United States doesn't want this war. And let's go and find a plan B, a backup plan for us, for France. How is that going? Because they were talking not just about Ukraine, they were talking about the case of Iran as well. What does France want from Putin?
I think that they want primarily for Putin to stop beating up on Ukraine. Because the French and the British, and you know, like when it comes to this Western imperial order of things, you always see that in the final analysis, Britain and France act in concert over centuries. It's not just now. And I think that, you know, Keir Starmer is a wet noodle. He's no personality, practically no charisma, no prior relationship with Vladimir Putin either. So I guess it came to Emmanuel Macron to speak with Putin after 3 years. I think that the French and the British are desperate to make sure that the government in Kiev remains aligned with the West, and that they keep the Black Sea coast open so that, you know, Kiev doesn't end up landlocked. So they want to keep Odessa under whatever's remained of Ukraine. And so the French and the British did start deploying troops to Odessa, not very large numbers, but some, because they are very, very anxious to make sure that Odessa and at least part of the Black Sea coast remains under Western control. And so I think that at this point, they want to try to make a deal with the Russians to keep them from going all the way to Dnieper and from going all the way to take Odessa and the rest of the coast of the Black Sea, which would be a major, major strategic defeat for the West, because not only do they get ejected from the Black Sea, they lose a beachhead for future actions against Russia, because, you know, you need a port where you're going to bring troops and weapons and ammunitions and drugs. You know, if you want to run an opium war against Russia, you need a port to bring the drugs. You need control over the customs, which the British did secure, and control over the port of Odessa. So you lose that beachhead. So that's a major loss, major strategic defeat. Not only that, if the Russians control the whole of Black Sea port, then part of the landlocked part of the European Union has a new outlet. Well, new. They have an alternative outlet. So let's say Austria, Slovakia, Hungary, Czech Republic. They are part of the EU, but they're the exit to the Black Sea goes by the river, by the Danube River. And now Danube River exits into the Black Sea between Romania and Ukraine. So if Russia takes over the whole coast of the Black Sea to Moldova and Ukraine, they can offer an alternative to the Hungarians and to the Czechs and the Slovaks and the Austrians and to say, look, you're landlocked, but you have the Danube and it comes into the Black Sea and we can trade. You can become part of our customs union, or you can join the BRICS. You have an outlet to a warm sea. So now, you know, they can, you know, the European Union cannot blackmail them as easily as they could now. So that's another reason why they are, the French and the British and the European Union, you know, Brussels, are very, very anxious that Russians don't take over Odessa. And so I imagine that Macron, seeing now that the Americans have stopped providing weaponry to the Ukrainians, that the Russians are progressing faster and faster against Ukrainian troops, that probably Ukrainian defenses are on the verge of complete collapse, and that at some point during this summer, maybe, the Russians could push relatively quickly all the way to the Dnieper. So that's game over for Project Ukraine completely. So now what do? You're getting defeated militarily. Now you have to talk to them, and now you have to say, like, please, 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 please don't take Odessa from us. Please, let's make a deal. You keep your four oblasts. We're going to lift sanctions for you. We're going to lift some sanctions against you. How about that? How's that? I don't know that the Russians care anymore. And I don't know. I think it's far too late for any of this. But we'll see. I imagine that this was the purpose of Macron's call to Vladimir Putin. And I also imagine that Vladimir Putin doesn't care at all, that he doesn't have to give them any concessions whatsoever.
I wouldn't be surprised, Alex, you mentioned the situation in Ukraine. I wouldn't be surprised if finally we learn that Netanyahu was a British project in his administration. He did everything. He did everything. He ran the Israeli government for such a long time. And this is something I think those people in the United States who are supporting Israel need to understand. The project Netanyahu has been defeated. Netanyahu is not anymore, even within Israel, many people are going against him. And look at the way that he managed the situation in Israel for such a long time. And finally, the defeat, he was going to score a big win for Israel, but he was defeated, in my opinion. And Donald Trump knows this. Donald Trump robs this in the face of Netanyahu in order to achieve whatever he has in his mind that would benefit the United States. These are two projects, and somehow, go ahead, and your take on that.
I absolutely agree with you, Nima. And my, you know, the deeper I look into this, the more evidence I find for it. And I think that sometimes really good evidence we get when the, you know, like when the politicians slip up and they run their mouth. And do you remember two or three weeks ago, the head of the British opposition, I forget her name.
Kemi Badenoch.
Exactly. Thank you. Kemi Badenoch gave an interview on I think it was Channel 4 or something like that. Yeah. And she said that Israel and Ukraine are fighting proxy wars for us. Yeah. They're fighting proxy wars on our behalf. How did she come up with that? Where did she ran her mouth and gave away the mindset of the ruling establishment in Britain. And I think that there's no doubt that Benjamin Netanyahu is their proxy errand boy. Maybe not in the same way as Zelensky is, because, you know, Netanyahu is politically a much stronger entity, much stronger. He's a more credible politician, let's put it this way. Whereas, you know, Zelensky is a clown, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The more you look into the two conflicts, Ukraine and Israel, the more you realize it's the same conflict, essentially. And the more you realize that it's being fought in the same way, more or less. Same dirty tricks, strategies, almost like they're concocted in the same center. And then you realize that the whole Qatar angle as well, you know, and the Hamas in Qatar, that these are... Qatar is a very close ally of Great Britain. Yeah. They even have two air bases in the UK where Qatari pilots and British pilots train together. Their deep state and intelligence services are deeply connected. Benjamin Netanyahu has been lobbying hard to fund Hamas, right? So it all kind of comes together. And then the Israelis support Azerbaijan. They arm Azerbaijan against Armenia. Israelis support the Kurds. They support the Ukrainians.
The Ukrainians trained the Syrian government to
get... Yes, and they now. You know, this moron of a UK defense minister, Healy, was talking about drones. Well, you know, then they train up Ukrainians to run the drones program. And so then when they needed drones in Syria, then they brought Ukrainians to train up the HTS jihadis to be able to use drones to attack Syria. So it all kind of connects together, and you really do see that it's basically the fault line is the Western Empire against everybody else. And the Western Empire, as it always has done, always works through proxies. And they always try to hide their hand. And, you know, like it's not just Israel, it's not just Ukraine, it's Azerbaijan. Very, very recently, they announced a military cooperation agreement between Britain and Kazakhstan. And then in February, they announced a military cooperation agreement between Great Britain and the government of Bosnia-Herzegovina, because they decided, the next front in the war between Russia and the West is going to be the Balkans, inevitably. This is what RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute in London, openly declared. So this business of arson attacks against peace, wherever they can, is continuing, and it's always emanating from London. And so then when you look at the way they act and the way they hide their hands, it's always the same thing. So they come with these military attachés, and they make they work with the target country's security services, and then they come with charities and NGOs and private contractors, and they start helping with education and modernizing the media and modernizing the markets and massaging the public relations. You know, you have a company called Albany Associates, for example, one of these private contractors. And Albany Associates is very active in Bosnia. And today, 60% of the Bosniaks think that the greatest threat to them is coming from Russia, which makes no sense whatsoever. But they're feeding them manure through the media nonstop. And, you know, people, they don't know what's going on. They read the newspapers and they say, well, these Russians are terrible people. They're really dangerous. Good thing the British are here to help us out, you know. And these same Albany Associates, earned their war stripes in Syria previously. So they've been working the Syrian opposition to undermine the government of Bashar al-Assad. And they've been doing this since 2012. And now there's been more than 1 million casualties in Syria. This is their business. This is what they do nonstop, everywhere, for more than two centuries now. Yeah. And so I'm 100% convinced that Benjamin Netanyahu is part of that. And another reason why I believe that is because he doesn't give a care about the Israelis either. You know, he was 4 years ago, he was there in Davos bragging about using the Israeli population as an open air experiment, live experiment for Pfizer, for their, you know, for their magical injections.
Alex, here is what Donald Trump said about his meeting with Netanyahu. He's going to, on Monday, if I'm not mistaken, he's going to meet with Netanyahu. It's not Donald Trump going to Israel, by the way. It's Netanyahu going to the United States. Here is what he said.
Netanyahu about funding. Oh, he's coming here. We're going to talk about a lot of things. We're going to talk about the great success we had. I mean, we had an incredible success. In Iran, we had an incredible success, like really nobody's had in many, many years. That was a precision war strike, and the word obliteration can now be used because the Atomic Energy Commission said you can't even get into the place. It was demolished. It was really demolished. It's a great, brilliant strike, and how to go forward. We're also going to talk about Gaza. We want to get the rest. We got a lot of hostages back, but we're going to talk about Gaza.
I love it. I have to laugh because I find the whole thing comical, which is inappropriate because it's not really. It's deadly serious. But Trump's whole gig is a little bit funny because, you know, he's insisting on this world demolished, and it's the greatest success there ever was. No military strikes were this precise and this successful ever in the history of the universe. I see what he's trying to achieve. But I personally think that if he was a little bit less bombastic, his lies would have a longer shelf life. Do you know what I mean? Because if you say, we obliterated Iran's nuclear program, I understand why he's saying that. He wants to remove the justification and the pretext for war. And he wants to get on with negotiating other things. But if he said, maybe, I think we inflicted very severe damage, but we don't know yet exactly what the damage is. We are now going to exert pressure on the Iranians to let our inspectors go in and verify everything. And then under that pretext, you can meet with the Iranians and you can negotiate and everything. And one day you can even, you know, get some footage of your investigators going there, maybe weeks or months later. And then you can say, yes, effectively, we destroyed there. So, you know, like you get a few months. But by going this bombastic and extreme, you can speak your truth, or, you know, like your truth, but immediately there's going to be the people who realize they got shafted out of war on Iran, and they're going to say, like, no, it hasn't been destroyed. The nuclear program, hey, you know, like, what about those 60% enriched uranium? Where is it? There's like 900 kilos. Where did it go? We need to find out where it went. We need to bomb everywhere. You know, we have to raid Iran again, and so forth. So you could have given yourself a few months maneuvering space by saying, we need to verify. We think we did a good job, but we need to verify. Like this, you know, now if Netanyahu falls, well, you're back to square one with who knows who. Who know? Ben-Gvir? Is Ben-Gvir going to be the next prime minister? Are you going to negotiate with him? Where's that going to go? I don't know. But, you know, I find Trump's antics a little bit comical, but I think that in a way he's making his life more difficult than it need be, and he's undermining himself by basically by lying too blatantly and too obviously.
Alex, we talk about IAEA and Palantir being part of those projects that they had in Iran. And here is the head of Palantir, Peter Thiel, talking about how he sees the future of humanity. Here is what it is. It's somehow scary when you see the way that they're pictured in the future.
Human race to endure, right? You're hesitating.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I would.
This is a long hesitation. This is a long hesitation.
There's so many questions implicit in this.
Should the human race survive?
Yes.
Okay.
But I also would like us to radically solve these problems.
Right.
And so, you know, it's always, I don't know, you know, yeah, transhumanism is this, you know, the ideal was this radical transformation where your human natural body gets transformed into an immortal body. And there's a critique of, let's say, the trans people in a sexual context, or I don't know, a transvestite is someone who changes their clothes and cross dresses. And a transsexual is someone where you change your, I don't know, penis into a vagina. And we can then debate how well those surgeries work. But we want more transformation than that. It's the critique is not that it's weird and unnatural. It's, man, it's so pathetically little. And okay, we want more than cross-dressing or changing your sex organs. We want you to be able to change your heart and change your mind and change your whole body. And then Orthodox Christianity, by the way, the critique Orthodox Christianity has of this is these things don't go far enough. Like that transhumanism is just changing your body, but you also need to transform your soul and you need to transform your whole self. And so,
right. But the other, wait. I generally agree with your.
Alex, do you get what this guy is talking about? It's transforming the mind. It's hard. If it's all about the heart and you can, it's something mechanical and you can, but the mind of people, the brain is everything. And how is that going to be the same guy that it was before?
I don't know what he's talking about, you know. It shouldn't be too controversial to say that we need certain transformations, you know, because, you know, I came to the conclusion that we will not be able to solve certain deep problems that are afflicting humanity at the moment without a spiritual renewal, an awakening, but more than that, you know, like a spiritual renewal that you need to establish new norms and mores in society so that certain types of abuse, certain types of you know, like usury. For example, usury in all major religious traditions is proscribed, yet somehow we have come to accept it. It's become a new normal. It's like a normal thing. Nobody even asked the question. So we need to go back to that. And that, you know, you can have legal barriers to that. But, you know, when somebody's incentivized, they'll always find loopholes, or they will create loopholes. And so you will, you know, when somebody begins to abuse the system, they're also gaining an advantage and they're making themselves more powerful than those people who abide by the rules. So you start getting an imbalance, which is basically what has happened to us over the last few centuries. And then they start forming the society and its legal code and its mores and its norms around protecting and defending their privileges and their advantages. And so law is not enough. There has to be also a spiritual aspect and you know, deeply rooted in our consciousness. So in that sense, I agree. But if Peter Thiel is talking about carving up human bodies surgically and inserting chips that they will power with their, you know, AI and all this, I think there he reminds me of Icarus, you know, who went flying too close to the sun, and at some point, you know, the sun melts the wax in his feathers, in his wings, and then he comes crashing to the ground and he dies. And I think that these techie guys are getting ahead of themselves. They think they hold the keys. They think that they can take God's role in shaping the advancement of life on Earth and humanity included. And I think that's 10 bridges too far. And I think that they'll can come crashing down, because all of this stuff that they do, if you extrapolate the progress of what they do, then the straight line goes to things that stimulate their imagination. And then they think like, oh, you know, we're going to have people fitted with the brain chips and interface between, you know, AI and brain and big databases. And remember Klaus Schwab talking to Sergey Brin in Davos and saying like, oh, can you imagine 10 years from now, we're all going to have a chip in our brain. So, you know, they fantasize about this, and then they probably get a little bit carried away and assume that things that can be done will actually be, you know, like conceptually could be done, that they will actually manage this and that they will actually run these things. And then they think like, oh, you know, this is God's domain. We are now encroaching on God's domains. We are gods. And I think that then you start flying too close to the sun. Yeah. And then, you know, the wax in your wings melt and you fall down, because these things are actually, you know, these technologies are very powerful, but they're also very fragile. They're fragile. They require a lot of maintenance. They require a lot of very dedicated, smart people working very hard to maintain them, to develop them in the desired direction. They can be hacked. They can be vulnerable to sabotage and to all kinds of, as you know, like as with any advanced technology, it's vulnerable to all kinds of things that can undermine it. They can misdirect it. They can put, you know, sand into the gears, and in the end, you know, we go back to being biological beings and not hackable animals. That's the reality. So their, you know, their idea that they're going to treat us like hackable animals and turn us into something that they need, which is basically slaves, like a termite colony, I don't think that's going to work out. That's like far too ambitious. And I think they're talking wishful thinking.
They want colony. They want, Alex, the new system. I was talking with Richard Wolff and Michael Hodson. When they're talking, it's all the same. The new sort of the slavery is just the slavery is living with us today. We haven't because we need to do something. And these new sort of ideas, as you've mentioned, the slavery gonna go bigger, and it's unbelievable if they get into that point.
Well, you know, there was this famous report from the Iron Mountain. I think the report was produced 1962, I think. And this was commissioned by U.S. banking interests. I don't know exactly which bank, because they don't name it in the report. And they brought together, again, a group of nameless experts from the Defense Department, from the intelligence services, from academia, from the military, and they produced this report called The Report from the Iron Mountain. And, you know, this is one of those things that they try to obscure, as in like, oh, no, this is not genuine. This is satire. This is satire. Somebody was joking. I read the whole report. There's nothing funny about it. This is not no satire. It's extremely dark and it's extremely disturbing. But basically, the authors come to the conclusion that inevitably they're going to have to drive the evolution of the system towards some kind of a modern form of slavery. And, you know, that it's going to have to be like a slavery based on very advanced technologies, but nevertheless a slavery. You know, basically that thing, you will own nothing and you will be happy. That slogan comes out of that mindset. And we are definitely, well, we are not moving in that direction, but they definitely, you know, the Davos said, the banking oligarchies, they definitely want to reform the society in this direction, which is why under the Great Reset, they were talking about changing what it means to be human. You know, Klaus Schwab explicitly was saying, we need to change what it means to be human. And then his mini-me, Yuval Noah Harari, was talking about humans being a hackable animal, like this whole business of ours being unique, divine individuals with a soul. That's over, you know. This is what they want. But at the same time, they are a very, very, very tiny cabal of low IQ inbred degenerates. And when I say low IQ, I'm not trying to insult them. I've looked very carefully into what they do, what they write, into some of their projects. And I came to the conclusion that these people are really not very smart. And the way these projects happen also very often is because they have a lot of money. And then you have a lot of these tenured professors in various universities who want money. They want grants for their research projects and blah, blah, blah. And then they mutually convince each other, like these researchers and professors, they want the grants. So they tell a story to these people. And then these people say like, oh, well, that's fantastic. Like, here's money, like, you know, do research on this. And so they're in this closed loop of groupthink, where they're convinced. This is why Klaus Schwab can go to Sergey Brin and say like, oh, imagine in 10 years from now, we're all going to have chips and I'm not going to know what you think and what everybody else in this room thinks. And Sergey Brin, who knows something about technology, is very embarrassed. He has, he has to kind of take a moment to think up some kind of a polite answer without saying, dude, you're an idiot. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. But anyway, you know, to long story short, it's a story of Icarus and flying too close to the sun and then crashing back to Earth. That's what we're looking at.
Yeah. I really do feel the same way, Alex. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Thank you again for having me, Nima. And until the next time, take care.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.